Hey Osiris listeners, we want to tell you about our friends at Sunset Lake CBD who support this show. Sunset Lake CBD is a Vermont hemp farm crafting affordable CBD products designed to help with sleep and stress without breaking the bank. If you haven't tried CBD before, take it from me, it's a game changer. I use Sunset Lake's tincture every night before I go to bed, helping me get solid, restful sleep. And their gummies are great for daytime. Check out their new Good Vibes gummies, which have just a bit of hemp-derived THC to help you relax and unwind. Sunset Lake CBD crafts products with hemp grown on their family farm and ships them directly to customers. They have tinctures, salves, edibles, coffee, smokables, and even pet products. By the way, their CBD chocolate fudge is awesome. Check them out today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use coupon code TIME for 20% off all products. Sunset Lake CBD, farmer-owned, Vermont-grown.
Osiris.
Hey, Mike, I can't see clearly. Is that a lightning bolt on your shirt?
You're damn right it is, Oteil. This is Section 119. Hey guys, we just got our hands on some great new gear from an officially licensed partner of the Grateful Dead, Section 119.
Oh yeah, Section 119. They sent me a pair of board shorts. They're actually really cool. I actually wore them on stage, and they were really comfortable. You know, I live in board shorts in Florida, so that's kind of my jam. And these have a cool print on them. Bertha's on there and the roses and stuff. I really like them.
I got one of the performance polos with the Grateful Dead bolt embroidered in the chest. It's super stretchy, and I love the way it feels when I'm on stage wearing it. I feel like I'm representing the dead and rocking out some jokes in style.
Section 119 was started by a couple of fans who wanted more than a latte to show their appreciation for the Grateful Dead. They started an apparel line that has everything you can imagine to represent the band at every occasion.
And not just the dead, they've got some amazing fish duds as well. From button downs with dancing bears all over it to board shorts with super vibrant prints and donuts all over your shirts and socks. They've got something for every fan for any occasion.
If you're looking for more than a t-shirt to celebrate the Grateful Dead, the folks at Section 119 make the highest quality apparel.
Boogie on over to section119.com and use code COMESATIME. That's all one word, comes a time, for 15% off your next purchase.
Hey, this is Oteil. If you're liking what you're hearing, head on over to patreon.com/comesatimepod and get your bus pass for an extra episode every week.
Welcome back to another episode of Comes a Time. I'm Mike.
I'm Oteil.
We had a pretty great one today. We had my friend, comedian Gary Gulman. Gary's last special, The Great Depression, directed by Judd Apatow, now viewable on HBO Max, was extremely special. And Gary's a great guy and a very vulnerable, open comic about his struggles with depression and anxiety. And where better for him to land than the Comes the Time podcast, right?
Absolutely. He is a funny, funny character, and I sure am glad that he made it through back to the other side, because he has so much to offer. And I thought it was really beautiful him talking about the process of him opening up about this stuff and the kind of feedback that he got and the encouragement. And it's really beautiful. I hope it helps us all to do that, whether on stage or not, you know, but just to open up, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, this, we always say it, we record the intros after the episodes, but I wanted to bring something up with you real quick, Oteil, that like, it got me thinking while we were talking, and we talked before the episode too about like, you know, we talk about doing the work and all that. Right. And like, once you start doing it, it's kind of impossible to stop. Like, you start working on yourself, you start figuring out things, and then you go like, oh, wow, you don't even realize it, but you've like started to walk into the forest, you know, and you're following that trail, and you can't see where you once were, and you don't know necessarily where you're going, but can't turn back. And there's certain times you can't stand still. Thunder don't get you. The variants will. And the thing that's interesting though about it is that like, I feel like it's a weird blessing in a way, because say you're sitting around, you know, I'm sitting around a comedy club waiting to go on, and all these different people walk in and stuff like that, you know, just like in life, just like sitting in an airport, you know, lounge, or sit being on the train or in a restaurant, you jive with those people, those frequency people, right? They find you, you find them. When you're kind of working on stuff, it seems like I'm finding the people that are working on stuff and that they're finding me. Is that, happening with you too? It's like the right people.
Absolutely. It's like, that's when you feel like, oh, it happened right when I needed it. You know what I mean? But I think that's part of it. Like when you get on the same, you're vibrating on the same frequency, you just kind of flock together somehow. You're attracted to each other.
Yeah.
Yes.
Conversations will come up, things will just organically go in a direction, and you're like, oh, fantastic. Like it doesn't have to be that surface level. 100 people could walk in and one person's like kind of, and it's really interesting.
That's what makes the work not, but it's work like, there's so many things that are like long-term projects, but I just didn't see like my mental health or my emotional or spiritual health as this long-term project. I guess because I was too busy drinking or whatever, just being a dumb kid. But now it's just like, I love this. I've always admired people that had gardens, like guys in my neighborhood that working on this garden for 20 years over a long period of time. And it's just this beautiful, my playing, you know, it's just a long work of art all the way, raising a child. This is a lifeline. And it's hard.
Yeah.
The rewards are just like so like unbelievable because of the long-termness of it.
Right.
Even, you know.
That's a good point. And it's nice to see when other people are kind of you know, doing that work on themselves or whatever. It's kind of a nice like, oh, you got a good garden going there. Like next year it's gonna bear some fruit. Yeah, totally.
That plant got big, boy. Look at that. thing. nice going
That's a beautiful garden you got there. Thank you for sharing it with us. Well, thank you to Gary and if you guys and I just have to say, and this is, I said it in the episode, but this right here, I've held on to this for quite a while. Okay, I mentioned to Gary that I was quitting cigarettes, and he mentioned that Alan Carr easy way, the way I quit was the same way. And I think that most stuff I'm saying doesn't really make a difference to anybody, and that no one remembers anything really. And he came back in about a week or two later or something with a gift card that said, you did it. And it was just like, that little gesture was just like the sweetest thing in the world to me. That meant a ton. And I've held on to it. I've used the gift card right away, but I held on to the sleeve and I keep it with, cause it's like, you know what it reminds me of? It's like, there are people that do care, that like, it's not, you're not completely alone in this universe. So
just a little reminder.
Yes, that's it.
You're loved.
That's it.
That's all we need, man.
I know. Very sweet.
That's all we need.
Yep. So, thanks for everything, Gary. And, thanks to the listeners, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And everybody, take good care of yourselves out there.
That's right. And we're not giving out mental health medical advice.
We are not giving out medical advice.
We're talking about our experiences.
It's simply for entertainment and information purposes only. We are not doctors.
That's right. And we love you.
I appreciate you coming on our program, Gary. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure. I always enjoy talking to you.
I love you so much because, and I'll give you three examples of things that you've done. We're always reminded of the crummy things that we do, right? Or at least we think we are. I want to remind you of three great things that you did. I quit cigarettes, and you came in out of nowhere with a Starbucks gift card.
Oh my gosh.
You did it. The goal.
Oh, wow.
Gary quit cigarettes, and I was talking to him about it before I did it, Oteil. And then you would remember. And as someone who's in my own head that thinks nobody cares, for you to come in and remember that I was quitting cigarettes and ask, and then you thought about me enough to stop and get me a gift card and write a personal note. I was fighting back tears of love. That's the first time I fell in love with you. The second was the first holiday party at the cellar that I went to after I was passed. I was standing there like a, Josh Baskin and Big when he turns back into a boy and he's in his dad's suit or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't really, you like came up from behind me and you put your arm around me and you're like, come on, let's go. I know all the good guys here. And you like, we went over and talked to Joe List and you like included me. That's an intimidating thing being at a,
oh yeah, it's ridiculous.
A comedy club holiday party when you're not really feeling comfy.
Oh yeah.
And, so it was the second time you saved me. And then putting out the Great Depression was the,
Man. So, well, all those things were an absolute pleasure. It's nice knows nice, right?
Yeah, the frequency. That's what we talk about all the time.
Oh yeah,
I really appreciate it.
Oh no, a pleasure.
Yeah. How's everything going with you right now?
I would say, if I could keep doing this for the rest of my life, I would be the happiest man in America. I go on the road. The shows go great. I come back. I love my wife. I have an excellent library of books. I play basketball almost every day. I'm very, very happy. I'm very grateful for what's become of me.
I'm glad it's hard. I was talking with my wife earlier about just the pandemic and the whole process that everybody's going through. That it seems people are either flowering and like turning from that caterpillar into a butterfly, or they're so scared of the butterfly thing because they don't know what it is, but they can feel it's big and they fold, you know?
Oh, wow.
I mean, I'm just like dealing with regular suicides. Like, it's pretty regular.
Oh, gosh. And,
but I also see people that are like really doing great. You know what I mean? It's all how everybody's responding to this, whatever's happening right now. So I'm glad to see that, you know, it's increasing your gratitude and
yeah,
all that. Cause it seems to be going either way.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, luckily I was able to build a sturdy foundation for my mental health, and I've been vigilant about maintaining it, just doing all the things I need to do to keep it going. And I mean, even something like this, I had a sort of a rule I developed when I was recovering, which was accept every invitation. And so people would, I mean, just people at shows that I didn't even know, they would say, hey, do you want to grab coffee with us? And I would say, yes, I do. It'll get me out of the hotel and it'll give me some inertia to begin the day, because that's the hardest thing to overcome every morning is the desire to just isolate and stay in bed or just avoid people.
You know, it was hard for me on the last tour we did, because I was actually finally to that place, like, okay, go hang out, accept every invitation. And then it was like, we couldn't hang with anyone.
Right.
We made this huge bubble. And oh my God, I had spiritual growth.
But, luckily, we had the podcast too, right? To be able to kind of, yeah. It's interesting. I was talking to my therapist yesterday, Gary, about that exact thing, about like continuing to do the work. And I think that's one of the things I kind of wanted to definitely make sure I brought up talking to you today, is that like, it's like, I'm calling it like a double-edged butter knife. Cause it's like, once you start doing the work, you can't stop doing the work. Like, the work doesn't end. I think that the hardest part of the work is acknowledging that you need it.
Yeah.
Right. And then once you start, it's like, all right, I'm in this forest that I'm kind of, I don't want to turn around and go back to where I started, but I'm definitely not at the end. And it's like those moments of kind of realizing like, oh no, I don't know if I'm ever going to find the end. Like, those are the hard parts. So
it's like that joke you told in the depression. You go, you know, the thing they don't tell you about life is that it's every day.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't stop. It's all day, every day.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. I will say, like, when I was writing that, there were 5 minutes that I was able to write while I was in the thick of it, that I was really sick. And that was one of the jokes about, about all the little things that indicate that you're depressed and that life is every single day. And it wasn't until I felt better that I acknowledged that the reason I was living like that was because I was very, very sick. And so when I first told those jokes, it was just something that I was making it sound like I was just a lazy person, but I was really just up against it and really in trouble. So I'm really glad that came through, because it was the one thing that I was able to get across, because it was so hard to write when I was sick, because I thought everything was terrible and my mind was really working slowly and it wasn't making connections and it was really damaged. So I'm glad that came through, because it allowed me, once I felt better, to have something to the grain of sand to build the pearl around in the oyster, if I can be obnoxious.
Well, that's an interesting point too, of like that your brain was not working and it was like connections were slow and stuff. Cause what I feel, excuse me, is like when I'm in the thick of a bad spell or whatever, right? When I'm feeling it, when I'm in the quicksand, my brain's working too fast and too slow simultaneously, where it's like there's a tornado of thought that I have no control over, but I'm in the eye.
Yeah.
And I could kind of see like all the stuff that I'm supposed to be doing or that I think I'm supposed to, and I can't grab any of it. And that makes me just so exhausted. And I think one of the things that is so important when we talk about stuff like this, and especially with the careers that we have, that like I know that if I, this fear of taking a break, there's a line a mile behind me, there a mile long of comics that are ready to just like slide right into where I am and I'm done, you know? That's that fear that I always, but it's that's what is that critic that's going like, you can't stop.
Yeah, but I always felt the same way until I did take that break. And yes, that first night when you go back to the club, you're like, oh man, I've missed it all. Everybody's far ahead of me. But what we don't take into account, one, is how lazy other comedians are. And two, that it's more important to let your art suffer for you than to suffer for your art frequently.
Yeah.
It's
thank you.
It's just this thing that I mean, I always think of Judd Apatow, who took 15 years off of stand-up, and yes, he got really famous in between, but his stand-up was really strong when he came back to it. He got better really quickly. And it's not a muscle you're going to lose. And also I think it was a friend in, well, I remember who the friend was. I won't say his name because it's an anonymous organization, but he learned from AA that he would tell himself, I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. And I find that such a relief to think about and to acknowledge. And I look back now at 51 years old, and everything was sort of a prologue to where I was supposed to be. That I would have shortened the length of my depression, but I'm not sure that I would be as vigilant about maintaining my well-being if it wasn't so severe. I think because I've had a lot of episodes that I came out of and I lost that dedication to exercising every day and get out. And I just, I think as difficult as it was, I really needed a real punch in the nose, maybe.
And our society's super like just brainwashes this kind of, you know, embrace the hustle.
Yeah.
You know, it's constant. And, you know, yeah, like suffering for your art is this like, it's this ideal. And I'm like, but yeah, you know, if you suffer too much, you die. So then I make no art. So how about, you know, but we never say, is it okay for our art to suffer for us, for me to get myself together? Like, you know,
yeah.
It was so hard, man, to like reverse that mentality of just gigging all the time. And I had kids late, so now I wanted to be home all the time. But it was like turning an aircraft carrier, you know what I mean? Mentally, to be like, I'm always like, yes, just yes, yes, yes. And I had to say, oh, now my mantra is just say no. Which I think it's funny because I always hated Nancy Reagan and I was a positive. But, you know, she gave me my mantra, you know, but it's a, trying to turn that around. And it's when you actually start to do it, you see how much the society is like trying to push you. Personally and just corporately, it's like it's hard. I'm definitely willing to let my art suffer for time with my 3-year-old and 6-year-old for my mental health, whatever. Like you just have to. It's war. You know, the consequences are you die.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
It's true, and I think also too in watching you and in watching. You know, I feel like there's times where I kind of go, am I doing this just to not do it? You know what I mean? When it comes to stand up and when it comes to like the grind and when it comes to all of it, it's like, if I pull into the breakdown lane for a minute, I sometimes hear myself up there and I'm like, I'm not even saying anything. Like that's worth saying. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, I'm just doing this because I figured out how to swim in this stream, kind of, sort of, you know, and then to see, like, you step out, fix the, you know, work on the engine, and now you're running a lot smoother, and there's like, you know, clean exhaust coming out and stuff like that's, to me, is like, then that's what's worth it about taking, like, you are helping so many people by being vulnerable and open and honest. And it's like, that's what this could be.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the main thing is that for 95% of my comedy career, I've looked forward to going on the shows. There haven't been nights where I was like, oh, I wish it would cancel. I wish there would be a snowstorm. I mean, that was one of the beautiful things I learned early on in comedy. I mean, within my first year that a show was canceled to a snowstorm in Boston, and I was really bummed out. And there had never been anything in my life where I was, other than sports, where I was bummed out if something was canceled. So that's it. But then you get to a point in comedy, if you're not feeling well, if you're not feeling creative, where you're like, oh, I hope the show gets canceled. And you really have to take a look at that and say, what am I doing? And part of the thing that I found really important when I returned to doing stand-up was that I couldn't let my mood be dictated by how my show went. And because it was, I knew that the audience had control over how I was going to feel about myself the next morning. And I had to relieve myself of that. And I happened to come across a quote from Beckett. I think his first name is Samuel.
Sammy B, big fan.
Playwright. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Waiting for Godot, right?
Yes. Is that his? Yes. Yes. Okay. I don't know why I always forget that his first name is Samuel, but
Thomas Beckett, maybe.
Yeah. That's it. He had this quote. It said, and it goes further, but this was the portion that really changed everything for me. It said, and I printed it out and I put it next to my bed, and it says, ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better. And that became my mantra, fail better. And it's probably no coincidence that it sounds like feel better, because I feel there's not a set that I wake up with the next the next morning, and it used to be every set, and for good and for bad, but it's really worthless to let your show dictate your mood. It keeps you from taking any risks,
right?
Which is the key to evolving as an artist. And you should fail. You should fail big. Whenever you can, or at least risk big. Yeah. And so that changed everything, because I used to start my show and tell the audience, you have no idea how much power over me, how I'll feel tomorrow morning. And it makes me resent you. And they would laugh, maybe because they thought I was kidding, but I was telling the truth.
It is so true. It's so true when you're doing a long set too. When you have an hour and it's the late show on a Saturday in some town, and parking was rough, or getting into the room, like so many unforeseen variables. They didn't flip the room fast enough from the early show, so everybody getting in is and this, the energy they bring in, and that 5 seconds you have in the beginning, right away, if you go, these people hate me, this is gonna suck, that hour is the longest hour, and you're already back in the hotel room mentally. It's the worst.
Yeah. It's like that Henry Ford quote, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right.
Yeah. So
it's like, if you're like, oh, this is going to suck. Well, if you think it's going to suck, it's probably halfway there. You know,
I've said that a couple times on stage where I'm like, God, if I could just start over, if we could all just go 15 minutes back, this would be great.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, it's funny that like there's something else that like the pandemic, I think, brought in too, that the first couple shows coming back out of it, I treated it like, well, this could be the last show. Because we didn't really know, right? And then it was that kind of like fail better, because who cares? This might be the last time. Do I want to go do the jokes that I know work mathematically? Or do I want to talk about how scared I am of everything right now? And how I had to, like, all my fears came true during this pandemic and all of that, you know? But and then that slowly, almost kind of like having like a good, like transformative moment mentally, just like everything, it kind of dies back down to like normal. You know what I mean? And that's the parts that I think, then you go back to kind of doing like, well, I have a 10-minute set. I kind of want to, do I play the hits tonight? Do I do, you know, whatever. And you get mad at yourself. But lately I've been thinking a lot about like, what am I saying up here? Am I actually doing anything with the time that I have?
Yeah. It's a great technique to say, what if this was my last show, and you would want to do some of the hits in your last show, but you would also want to do a couple of things that you've been working on and thinking about, and say them without any pressure that they work. I mean, I heard a conversation between Penn Jillette and my friend Brian Koppelman. They were on, Brian has a podcast, but anyhow, they were talking about the idea of something working. So whether it's a song or a magic trick or a joke, and we become so attuned with whether something works rather than what we're saying and whether we're moving towards something. Like, I remember when I first became a comedian, I did whatever it took to get laughs. And then I wanted to go into a thing where I was just myself, and the transition was very uncomfortable. Going into just being myself and talking about what I wanted to, I was bombing. And I remember a friend who's a really good friend when you think about it, because he told me the truth. He said, "You're getting worse." But I had such conviction over what I was doing. I said, no, you don't understand. I'm going to get worse for a while, but this is what I need to do. And I eventually forgave him, but it was hurtful. But it's incredible though that he was such a good friend because we see it all the time in show business. People who have nobody around them who are telling them the truth.
That's so true.
And they're getting worse and nobody has the balls to tell them that at the very least they've gotten really overconfident because their audiences are so devoted to them and are not giving them authentic feedback. So, I mean, which reminds me of another great quote from Bruce Springsteen, where he says, you have to think you're a badass and that you suck simultaneously. Otherwise you can't be honest. But you can't think you suck more than you think you're a badass. There has to be a balance. So it's one of my favorite things to reflect on, because there's a positive thing to not being all that famous in that you really have to work for your laughs.
Very true. Very true.
It's easier to get better when the audiences don't know who you are. You're challenged every night. Those comedians, we see them who start their shows with just the people can't stop clapping.
Yeah.
They have to tell them, please stop. I need to get some jokes out here and
love me less.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the feedback they're getting is not the same as the feedback we're getting at the Comedy Cellar in particular.
Yeah. There have been times when some famous folks will go on and the crowd is so gratuitous in the beginning. And then 30 minutes into these, you know, told name comics just going, what to talk about next? To talk about, like, things that a young comic who, which by the way, I want to say, I feel like our career is a perpetual audition too, by the way. I never feel comfortable. I don't think I've ever passed anywhere. Yes, you're passed, but it'll end. It's going to end. You're going to ruin it. Right. Yeah. So, but then these famous folks, and then they'll be up there just working out the seed is being germinated for an hour or a year from now, hour special or whatever. Right. And the people will be walking out and they'll be like, I don't know if he knew he was going on tonight. He wasn't very funny. They would come up and ask it. I'm like, no, this is what you're watching us work out. Like, not everybody, you know, like in a year you're going to go, I remember that. I remember when that was, but that night it wasn't good enough for the crowd or whatever. It's so funny.
Yeah.
See the difference. And then someone else is going up and going like, I'm laying it all out. I'm cutting my veins and leaving it all on stage. People are like, wow, can you believe we just saw Chris Rock? That was unbelievable. No one's paying attention.
Oh, I know. But
that's the whole thing of like feeling better that you were talking about. Like, if your intention is like, you know, something deeper and it's not going to land right away, you know, like it's like your friend said, you're getting worse. So you're like, okay, yeah, but I'm trying to fail bigger and better.
Well, see, right. And in comedy, Gary, I'd love to hear you, like, your thoughts on this, because that's a hard, like, look, if your jokes, there are some guys that we know that are literally just like mathematical joke masters. A plus B equals laugh. A plus B equals laugh. Boom, 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 boom. When you're going for a large, like a thesis, your MLA format, thesis statement, right? That's hard when you basically kind of have like short sets. New York, for those who don't really know, I mean, we're doing 10, 15, 20 at the most.
Yeah.
Time after time after time. How do you dissect a larger opus and kind of like go chunk by chunk? Is that something like, did you have to rework how you approached your sets and stuff with that?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing with the Great Depression is the best example of it, was that I couldn't practice it at the Comedy Cellar because you've got 10 or 15 minutes, and to tell people that you were suicidal and that you were hospitalized.
Then you get the light.
And then all of a sudden you get the light. But also, we just saw somebody kill, and somebody after you is going to kill, talking about things that are lighter, much, much lighter. And so I would occasionally throw in a good line like I had this story about when I was in the hospital, I got recognized. And so I would say, I think what I said was that I was hospitalized. Raise your hand if you've ever been recognized in the psych ward, and either out of nervousness or because it was a funny image, they would laugh. So I got to try that out and prove it would work with an audience that wasn't there to see me. But this is what was so important with working out the Great Depression. By that time, I had developed enough of an audience that would go see me that pretty much knew my sense of humor, trusted me, and knew that I was going to be funny. And here was something also that was going to be something we didn't know about him. So they were very generous and patient with me as I worked it out over the year that I wrote it. And so 5 years before, I couldn't have gotten as much as I got, because I wouldn't have had the permission from the audience. So it's a bummer, but that's stand-up comedy. When you need the best crowds when you're beginning, you get the worst crowds. And when you don't when you don't need the best crowds, all of a sudden you only have people there to see you.
That's so true.
I think it's kind of your reward after having to win over crowds that don't give a crap, you know?
Right.
So I mean, on the back end.
Yeah, I could have written it word for word the same thing, but I wouldn't have had the confidence and experience, and more importantly, maybe I wouldn't have had the audience to receive it that would have been receptive.
And you probably wouldn't have had the comfortability in the silent moments.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I always called them the nonfiction moments in my act. Not that the jokes are fiction, but they're just they feel less heavy. And so the nonfiction moments when there was no laugh coming, where I would just say, Oh yeah, I wanted to swallow a bottle of sleeping pills, and there's no joke. I mean, that's something you really can't always get away with get away with that at Side Splitters in Tampa.
You know what's funny though is
let's have a hand for your staff.
Like, yeah, you say it's heavy, it's more heavy, or something's less heavy, and I guess I'm just on the same frequency with you, because when you go to that stuff, that's the stuff to me that feels like a relief. That's the stuff that removes weight, and I go, oh yeah, you know, it's not just me. It's that's the life-saving shit, man, right there for me.
Yeah.
So but I'm glad that you just have that courage and intention and conviction to do it. Was there an event or something that happened that was a turning point for you? I'm always interested when people are at their bottom, like what was that? What turned it around?
I mean, the turning point was chemical. I remember it was maybe August of 2017, and I had been, the most recent time I was in the hospital, I think that year was May of 2017. And I had gone through a number of outpatient electroconvulsive therapy, and this was my sort of second round. The first one I had done inpatient, and then some outpatient maintenance, and then I had relapsed, and I went back to ECT because I was so sick. And then those rounds ended in June, I think, or maybe May. I'm not sure on the timetable, but anyhow, I tried a couple of different medication combinations, and then like 10 days after starting what I'm taking now, which is Cymbalta and Remeron, I had a cup of coffee, and it had the effect that it used to have on me. There were a couple of years where drinking coffee did nothing for me, And then one morning, I had this coffee and I was like, wait a minute, this is how I used to feel when I had coffee when I was feeling better. And the term I always use is I felt like a god. And as Bill Murray said in Groundhog Day, not the god, but a god. And and all of a sudden I was like I was creative and I was energized, and it didn't stop the next day, and it just kept going. And I will say I wasn't prime myself, but I got that charge, and it enabled me to do things such as wake up before noon, exercise regularly, go out to eat with people, meet people for breakfast or lunch or coffee, go to my show and feel that if it went poorly, I would be able to get out of bed the next day. So I was able to read for the first time in years. And I mean, this year, for instance, I've read 83 books. Last year I read like 90 something. I mean, I read all the time. And when I was sick, I didn't read for 2 years. I didn't read a single book for 2.5 years. So that was when chemically I started to feel better. The thing was, is that creatively, the turning point was when I started to perform, and I had to address what I looked like and how my hands were shaking and that I was a mess. And the best way for a comedian to talk about anything is through jokes. So I was making jokes about having just been out of the hospital. And then another turning point was when, with encouragement from my manager and the man who was directing my special, he said, nobody's going to not want to work with you because you talk about having electroconvulsive therapy. It'll make the show different from almost everybody else's show. Yeah. If you talk about it, and that's I don't know what catnip really does, because I've never taken it, but to a comedian telling me nobody else will be talking about this, that's catnip for me. I whenever I think nobody else can talk about this or is talking about this, I gravitate to that, because it's so hard to distinguish yourself as an artist in any field, but comedy in particular. I mean, Mike and I, we do shows where there are four other comedians on, and sometimes four other comedians have talked about the same thing, whether it's topical or it's something everybody is gravitating towards. And so once I had the permission where my manager wasn't like, it's going to destroy your career if you admit to having this treatment. Because I don't know why I thought that. Like, this is what I thought, that people would be so put off and bummed out and they would feel uncomfortable around me. Because to be honest with you, growing up, if somebody was open about their mental illness, it made me anxious. It made me nervous. I felt so sorry for them. And I didn't know how to behave around them. And luckily there've been other people who have been open about it. And we've all had the opportunity to realize, oh, it doesn't matter. It makes them more interesting to us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think when you see people like Robin Williams, that is like, you know, it's like, I think there's more people that are exposed to it now and also suffering, like, thank God more people are talking about it. You know, it keeps going back to this theme that is always reoccurring in our podcast of our pain being our gift. Also, you know, it's our unique pain. It's our tailor-made hell. It's what also, you know, it's the food and fuel and uniqueness of our life and fuel for doing the craft and whatever, you know.
Hey there, Osiris listeners. I wanted to tell you about our friends over at Smart Wool. For more than 25 years, Smart Wool has been making merino wool socks and apparel designed to keep you comfortable. Because they want to help you play, laugh, and explore in the outdoors with every thread they knit and every step you take. Because they believe that comfort sharpens focus and lets you perform beyond your limits. They're here to help you feel good. Now it's up to you how far you will go. Take 15% off of your first order at smartwool.com. Smartwool. Go far, feel good.
What's up, everyone? I'm Mike.
And I'm Oteo.
And these are our Sunset Lake CBD gummies that are almost gone. Sunset Lake CBD is a farmer-owned business that ships CBD products directly from their farm to your door.
For years, Sunset Lake was a Vermont dairy farm producing milk for Ben and Jerry's ice cream. In 2018, they diversified and started growing hemp for CBD.
And with a product for everyone, they offer pre-rolls, hemp cigars, and hemp flowers, as well as tinctures, gummies, and CBD crafted coffee to help with stress, aches, and pains.
Sunset Lake CBD saves you money by shipping high quality CBD products directly from their farm to your door.
Want to know what I've been using a lot of, Oteil? This salve with the arnica.
Yeah.
On my old bones. You get back from a show and you got tore ankle, rub a little bit of this on there. You're ready to dance the next day. And, you know, Sunset Lake comes a time. Listeners can visit sunsetlakecbd.com and use promo code TIME for 20% off of their purchase. That's sunsetlakecbd.com, promo code TIME. And tell them we sent you.
Gary, is guilt a side effect of your anxiety or depression? Like, do
you
have
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. The guilt was, I mean, It was overwhelming, and in the light of health, of being better, the guilt I was feeling, I won't dismiss it, because I did do, like, one in particular that I remember spending a 45-minute session with my therapist was that when I was 8 years old, I made fun of a girl's weight and she cried. And I was convinced that everything that was happening to me was a punishment for that and similar things I did as a kid. And he said, yes, it was terrible to call that, to do that, but you are not being punished. And there was no way to convince me that I wasn't being punished. My brain was so damaged that there was no way I could get out from under that. And then as soon as I was feeling better, when that coffee kicked in that day, I said, yes, that was terrible. And you shouldn't have done that, but you were 8 years old. You're a much better person now. And you've tried to make up for it. And I mean, this sounds crazy, but I did a show that January when I was feeling better, and it was sort of like the show that, if nothing else had happened afterwards, it could have been considered a tremendous triumph. But it was really just a New Year's Eve show that I felt myself for the first time, and it was in Boston. And I mean, this sounds made up, but I got an email from that girl and telling me how funny the show was. And she did not bring up the fact that I had made her cry when I was 8 years old. And, wow. And it was really the timing was extraordinary. And my wife said, well, Mercury is in retrograde, which is an astrology thing, but I'm telling you, it was eerie. It was really eerie. And I wrote her back, and I didn't mention the incident, but I was so incredibly grateful. It was extraordinary.
Wow. You still could, you know?
That's yeah.
You could email and go, you know?
Yeah.
I'm really sorry I did that a long time ago. She'd probably be, I did that with someone and they didn't remember.
Yes. That happens so frequently.
Yeah. And I was like, you carried this shit. I mean, it was a little thing, but it was, you know, I was like, you want to see? It's a little infected thing right there, you know? And it's,
yeah.
But I'm just glad I did it, you know?
Yeah.
Wow. It's interesting that I you know, I think about sometimes when you want to, when you feel that push to actually say something with your time on stage, who it may hurt or who it may, you know, like I automatically, like the critic in my head's kind of like, well, you don't want to say too much about your childhood, or you don't want to say this about that, or you don't want to do that because, like, could it upset someone, or could it hurt someone that you love, or could it, you know, whatever. And it's this kind of
Gary,
constant.
You were busting on your mom.
But you could tell that you guys love each other so much that it was like, really, you know, that part kind of sometimes like weighs on me quite a bit.
Yeah, I get that. And it, to me, it depends on what you have a stomach for. And initially what you can not feel too guilty about, but also as an artist, you're entitled to using everything. And it might be a situation where the people that you discuss have to be understanding of what art entails, but you don't want it to be gratuitous. And you don't want to be just up there grinding axes, right, but right. I mean, some of the
Carmen's great. A bitch. It's like, you did it.
That's the part. Yeah. See, that's the part that's hard sometimes. It's like, no, wait a minute. That's actually my story to tell.
Yeah.
You forget that sometimes. You're like, oh, wait, no, I actually can talk about it because it happened to me.
Yeah.
I paid the tab. I'm still paying the tab for the story.
That's hard sometimes to when you're always wrong in your mind, you go, it's always my fault.
Oh my God.
That's hard. Yes. Super hard to like to justify it. Sometimes.
Yeah.
Man.
I was explaining yesterday to, I've got this amazing hypnotherapist that I go see, and she's really, really great. And she's someone who, like, I'll be thinking about something and she'll text. And it's like, we've got that weird kind of like frequency thing but we were talking yesterday about how there's like these moments when you have moments of clarity and you have moments of bliss and moments of kind of like being out of the noise and the clutter. It's nice because you know it's there, but it's frustrating sometimes because you can't live there all the time. Know what I mean? Like, you know that you can have a happy moment and you can't. And one of the things you talked about in the Great Depression was, and I think it's, I mean, I cracked up out loud when you dress like a horse to go get ketamine. I mean, that was just the greatest. Like, you go, like, he wouldn't give it to me anymore, so I went and dressed like a horse. Like, that to me was just so beautiful and just a subtle little fucking bang, you know? But I've had experiences with like psychedelics where I've had a really long, a week or two after, my mind works how I wake up, and before I even open my eyes, my critic is kind of like on his third cup of coffee, looking at his watch, like, let's go, you lazy ass. We got so much you didn't do yesterday. Yeah. We didn't even think about what you did in high school yet, you piece of shit, you know, and on and on and on. And it waking up after doing, you know, a psychedelic thing or whatever, reminded me of when I quit cigarettes, where I'd wake up and the first thing I would think is like, aren't I supposed to be feeling something right now? And it's like, oh yeah, now is when I'd first think about smoking a cigarette.
Yeah.
Like before I even open my eyes, it's like, gotta go smoke a cigarette so I could take a shit this morning, you know? But that critic, when I was not feeling anxiety or panic, I'd go, aren't I supposed to be like beating the shit out of myself right now about something? And it's like, oh, I don't have to.
No.
And it's such a beautiful, like, so sometimes it's realizing it's not what you feel, but what you don't feel is some of the most beautiful, blissful moments of, I say to people who don't understand anxiety, like when I realize that none of this matters, that's the most beautiful feeling.
Yeah.
Cause everything fucking matters way too much. And they're like, wow, that's pretty depressing that nothing matters. Like that's, and I'm like, no, no, no. You don't understand how relieving that is.
Yeah. Everything mattering way too much is depressing.
Everything matters far too much.
Yes.
And it's just wild to have those. Like, so did ketamine, like, I like hearing you kind of say, cause I'm having a bit of a personal like struggle with the whole like medication versus not medication. Uh-huh. And I try very hard to not take it.
Okay.
But I need it. I definitely need it. And it's a hard thing to kind of admit sometimes, because it's like, I want to do it on my own and I'll take breaks from it here and there, Lexapro and other whatever. But yeah, it's sometimes when I'm off it, I'm kind of like,
yeah,
I kind of think I might need this, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a proponent of it. My doctor, I have a thing sometimes where I get anxious, and I used to try to white knuckle it. I really thought that was the way to get through it and to get stronger. And my doctor said that the chemicals you're secreting, and I want to say it's cortisol, are making it worse.
Yeah.
And also prolonging your suffering. Don't white knuckle it. You're protecting your brain and you're protecting your mood by taking, I take Klonopin. Now there are medications that become addictive that can have a sedating quality. And so I'm really an advocate for using whatever works, but sometimes I go through sort of a difficult morning or afternoon, and I'll ask myself, have you exercised? Have you talked to anybody today?
Yeah.
Have you gotten out of the house? Mm-hmm. And if the answer to those are no, then I'll try those before I take a Klonopin. And usually that's all I need. I mean, I also added Transcendental TM to my regimen, which is very helpful. So you want to add to your arsenal. And there are also certain people you can call and or meet up with that are sort of human antidepressants. I mean, I have friends who I call, and sometimes it's only just mentioning the dynamics at a comedy club we work at, and we discuss it, and then we're like, okay, I'm not crazy. This comedian stinks, and is I'm not losing my mind, and right. And it's enough, or this article that I sent you is capturing exactly what we are feeling right now. I mean, it's yeah, so helpful to not be alone with this misery or anxiety. And I mean, what you're doing here with the podcast, it's exactly what I'm telling people to try to do as frequently as needed. And I mean, the idea of I have to be doing this, I have to be doing that, I have to be hustling. I mean, up until a few years ago, you had to have a job in order to have health insurance. And if that wasn't a bug in capitalism, it was a feature to keep us working and on the treadmill. And for the people who didn't have health insurance, they were doing jobs they hated and were miserable and were contributing to the thing that they needed health insurance to fight off. They were miserable because they hated their job and they needed the health insurance to get the antidepressant to make them able to do this thing that they hated, which would keep them from needing an antidepressant. I mean, it sounds made up. It's so twisted.
It's the wheel, man. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the big lie. That's the big lie, you know.
And people say, Gary, what do you want? Socialism? I cannot wait.
I know, right? I'm like, if that's what you call it.
Yeah. Fine.
I don't know.
Last time I checked, all these other countries are capitalists. I'm just saying they're practicing capitalism and they have health care.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, I don't want, it's like, it's all, yeah. So, but I really love your thing about SSRIs, because we're
not doctors. First of all, let's say we're not doctors. We're not giving medical advice. Yes.
But, you know, in the Grateful Dead community, there's a lot of psychedelics. We've had a lot of people on talking about psychedelic therapies and stuff. And I think some people feel like we're kind of maybe campaigning against SSRIs and that kind of thing. And I love that part of your show. You were like, people are asking me about, well, what about the side effects, man? Doesn't that bum you out? He's like, the side effect is death. If I don't take it, I think I'm cool with dry mouth, you know, like. I just was dying. Oh, I was like, that is so true. Because if it's, I know a couple of people where they're not their old selves on their medication that works. And it took them a long time and it almost cost them their lives a number of times before they just came to terms with it and said, this is not my old self, but I'm alive.
Yeah.
And they're like happy now.
Yeah.
They're not their old selves.
Yeah.
Well, but, you know, I mean, I am so glad that I get to be with them and see them and still love them. And we still laugh and they're, that person's still in there, you know, but and they it was beautiful watching them come to terms with it, you know, and just being like, yeah, now I'm grateful for these medicines.
Yeah. You know?
It's unbelievably exhausting to be like to be in the thick of a bad spell. And it's so tight. Like you wake up, like you said, like rolling over and going back to bed. Like my guilt gland gets so like active where it's like, get up. Even if you have nothing to do, you got to get up and find something to do. Cause that work thing of don't, you know, and the medication is finally something that's like, nah, it's cool. You can let that guy scream. We could shut the window. Like we don't have to hear it, you know? And I think one of the things that, I want to ask you about this because, you know, in the documentary part, in the movie, including your wife, including your mother, including Bobby, including the trip to the psychiatrist, I think a lot of people have a hard time finding someone that they can trust. And I think that with medicine, especially, I've had folks that literally just like you go into the doctor and you mention anything and they're like, well, here's a script for this, here's a script for that, here's a script. And it's like, this person doesn't care. And when you're in that thing of not trusting anybody, it's like, can you give me a hug first before you give me these prescriptions? Cause that's really what I need. It's just, I need you to hug me and never let go till I die, you know? Yeah. But that part of it is hard. Did you find it hard to find someone you trusted? Did you go from doctor to doctor or psychiatrist to psychiatrist? Or like, do you have any advice for people who are listening maybe that are with someone they hate? Or I know friends who have tried it, tried therapy, and their therapist ends up being someone that honestly probably shouldn't be in therapy.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a great question. And it is so frustrating because there have been, I mean, I had a psychiatrist in Los Angeles who would literally just ask me a bunch of questions, type them into his computer without looking. And then apparently it would spit out a diagnosis and a medication.
A yeah.
And it was infuriating. And I got to New York City. An audience member mentioned either to me or in another comedian, and I don't do a lot of crowd work, but this person said that they were a psychiatrist. And I went up to them after the show and I said, can you recommend somebody in New York City? And she wrote down a number. I called that guy. I met with him. He said, I don't have the room in my schedule to treat you. Here's another guy. And that guy was the guy who was in my, in my special. And he's amazing. And the thing is though, that I would have kept going, but it is hard because a lot of times it's hard just to call and pay your phone bill and get caught up on that or change your password. Sometimes I always think my recovery could have been undone at any point if my phone had stopped working, if I hadn't been able to pay my bill and that, I mean, there were just so many things. So I understand where you're just, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know.
Yeah.
But I really am so glad that I didn't stay satisfied with being half miserable, because eventually you're full miserable. And the other thing I always tell people, and you gave great evidence of this a minute ago, where you wake up and you're beating yourself up for not feeling well. And at the very least, you don't have to enjoy not feeling well, but if there's some way you can get some perspective and objectively say, I am not going to beat myself up for being sick. I deserve at least the dignity of recognizing this as an illness, as serious as the illnesses that you wouldn't yell at somebody, including yourself, for having.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a great point.
Right. Because if you had cancer or whatever,
yes,
nobody's going to, your critic has got nothing for that.
Yeah.
You know, we need to disarm that critic and be like, man, screw off.
Yeah.
It's okay for me to feel bad, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's super important that the way that you ended the special too was that, and it wasn't, you know, every comic, well, that you end on a joke, but the thing that was important, the denouement, is that what it's called? The climax, what is it? The climax,
yeah.
And then the,
yeah, the denouement. Know. Yeah.
That's a good, I remember that now from English class. You go, you just stood up there naked and you said, you are not alone. And that's so fucking important, Gary. And it's like, yeah, that's the thing I think that I hope you understand how much that resonates out, because doing comedy and feeling like I can't be honest with any of these people because they're all judging me and right, we're all jealous of each other. And we all think that everyone else's life is so great and mine sucks. And why is it so hard for me? And how come I'm sitting here in this room and my ears are ringing and I can't hear what anybody else, but everyone else looks like they're having such a great time hanging out with everyone. And when you realize you're not alone, it sort of brings a sense of like empathy, but also community to the fact that we're all just dented cans.
Yeah.
And we're all kind of like, you see somebody come in the olive tree or whatever, you see somebody come into another club and it's like, instead of judging them, you kind of are like, all right, maybe they're just a ball of nerves too, you know?
Yeah.
And it feels good in two ways, because it's like, I don't want to judge, but also maybe I could feel okay feeling not okay around everybody, you know? So to see, you know, hear you say that, and that was the most important line of that whole thing to me, man, was that it's
thanks.
I really can, it's okay to feel like banged up.
Yeah.
Because when you take the chance and admit it on stage, it's such a relief to so many people.
You take a deep breath after you say it, and I'm like, fucking, yeah.
I can't be the only one that's feeling relief instead of like, oh, now I'm getting nervous. You know, I just can't. There's a lot of people out here, man, having a hard time right now.
Oh, man.
You can hear it, man.
That's so beautiful to hear. I mean, that idea, you're not alone, has come back to me so many times with people telling me it made me feel less alone. It made me feel seen, the show. And I can't say that I intended for people to give me that back. But I think whenever you open yourself up, whenever you're vulnerable, you'll find that people are appreciative and will let you know. That was the thing that people say, oh, it was so brave of you to talk about this on stage. But almost immediately when I started talking about it, I started getting feedback from audience members that was unlike every feedback I had gotten afterwards. People would say, you're so funny, my stomach hurts, but people weren't saying the things that they were saying, and it wasn't as moving to them as this was. And you don't want to, or I don't say you,
the I don't royal go, way. Yeah.
I don't want to go all the way where all I'm doing is being heavy and vulnerable and there's no easy laughs. But there's a a compromise in between that, which is a very funny show that also you give something of your, of yourself, and you make yourself vulnerable, and that, and that's the direction I want to continue to go in with my comedy, and hopefully this book that I'm writing, which is a memoir, and it's funny, but at the same time I share some really some really hard times and some misery, but I mean, the other thing that I wanted to share with you, because Mike and I, we like to talk about books, is that there's in Kurt Vonnegut's The Sirens of Titan, there's and if you haven't read it, I can't recommend it enough. It's my favorite book. And there's a character in it who's the second wealthiest person on the planet. And the reason he's the second wealthiest person on the planet is that he knows this thing about human beings, which is this: they, when you ask them how they're doing, they tell you they're great and they've never been better. But he knows the truth is that they're miserable and that things couldn't get any worse for them. And it gives them an advantage in every interaction they have, that they know he knows the human condition. And I mean, I don't think that everybody is having a perfectly miserable time of it, but I think that a lot of the people are having a hard time, and rather than take advantage of them to be the second richest person in the world, take advantage of that to feel better about yourself and also be more empathic.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great point, man. I appreciate it. And you know, you've been there a lot of, you've appeared at a couple of really hard times with a gift card to Starbucks and an arm around my shoulder and said, come on, let's go have a good time at the party. And it means a lot. And to see you being so funny and vulnerable, and just you. I mean, we sit and talk about the Beatles like it's like you're someone that I could just pick up where I left off every time, and it's genuine, and just thanks.
Yeah,
in all honesty, just thank you.
A lot of people have been an arm around my shoulder and a Starbucks gift card, and I'm sure you've been a Starbucks gift card and arm around a shoulder. So yeah. It's just as I've never seen Pay It Forward, but it seems like a valuable piece of advice.
That's a good point. I never have either, but that's like the one movie where like the title's like, yeah, I don't need to see it.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah, totally.
Thank you so much, Gary. I really
thank
appreciate
you. O'Teal, it was such a pleasure to meet you and talk with you, and hopefully we'll intersect in person.
I hope so soon, now that we can hopefully start doing that again. But this is like, thank you. I just want to say thank you so much.
Oh, no, my pleasure.
You know, we could just have musicians and comedians on, and that's fine. But, you know, I want to talk about this stuff. And
I love it.
You have balanced that thing very well between the heavy and vulnerable and the laughter. And I've really, really enjoyed your special. I can't wait to get together in person.
Oh, awesome. Thank you. All right. Bye, guys. Thanks so much.
See you, Gary. Thanks a bunch. See you soon.
Osiris.